So good morning to all of you. I was raised and born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, where I was baptized. I was the second of four children born to, believe it or not, John and Mary Smith. So you can now say you knew, you saw somebody that is actually was a daughter of John and Mary Smith. My grandmother was Mary, and her husband, my grandfather, was John. My sister was Mary. My brother is John. And I had about five great Aunt Marys and about three Uncle Johns. So we were Catholic, and everybody that I knew was Catholic. My aunts and uncles, you know, all our neighbors, all 29 kids that lived in eight houses on my block were Catholic. And we all walked together to the Catholic grade school. And I was very comfortable in my Catholic skin. You know, my parents taught us how to pray. Before I started kindergarten, I could say the rosary, as could my siblings. And my mother was a very staunch Irish Catholic woman. When I was 9 years old, my grandfather died. And he was my best friend. Sorry, all these years later, I still pray for him. And he was always my protector from my older sister, who was always playing tricks on me. And, you know, I was the butt of her jokes. But I love her. Always have, always will. That's the one who's named Mary. But anyway, when I was in high school, freshman in high school, I joined a club called the Antoinettes. And our job, myself and a classmate took two buses and we walked about four or five blocks to the convent of the Little Sisters of the Sick Poor. And they had a nursing home attached to the convent where they, you know, took care of the elderly. And what we did was we made bed pads for the elderly. And pretty soon I'm looking and I'm saying, you know what? Someone's going to be making bed pads for me before too long. And but I just really liked it. And I thought back then that I might become a sister. And the only sisters I ever knew were the Dominicans, and because they were our teachers. And really loved those big, long black rosary beads that they used to carry around their belt. But the Little Sisters of the Sick Poor was so different. They were so sweet and so kind to everybody that they met. And it was kind of a challenge for me thinking about, you know, where I wanted to go in my life. And of course, then I met boys. And I hung out in a crowd of about 16 teenagers. And we went to parties at one another's houses. And we went to the beach together, and we went to the church, had a dance every Friday night for the teenagers, and we were always there. And we all went to Mass together on Sunday. Well, I got a call about 2 years after I started hanging out with these kids, and it was one of the boys, whose name was Bob, a little giveaway there, and he invited me to go to his cousin's wedding with him. Now, I'd never been to a wedding. Because in New York, only the adults go to weddings. You know, the kids stay home with a sitter because the adults want to have fun. And so that was my first wedding. And I remember when they were going to throw the bouquet, I was a little nervous, and Bob's cousin, Carolyn, she said, oh, you've got to get in there. You've got to catch the bouquet. So we caught it together. And I said, well, you know, now what do we do, split it? And she said, oh, no, this is how it's done. And we still laugh about that today, but she said, I will keep the bouquet. And what you do is when they ask who caught the bouquet, you go up. So I was in the hot seat, and but I did have a very good time at the wedding. And we dated throughout high school, college, and on January 25th, 1969, I married my best friend, Bob. And I've known him since I was 13, but started dating him when I was 15. And It was different back then. You didn't date somebody and go to bed with them the same night. You know, the first date. We waited 5 years, and then we got married. But after we got married, we moved to a Spanish neighborhood, and it was right after Vatican II they were starting to implement a lot of the changes that took place after Vatican II. And for those of you pre-Vatican II, you know what I'm talking about. And for those of you, you know, after Vatican II, you have no idea. I apologize for that, but it's not my fault. Anyhow, we moved to a Spanish neighborhood. And we went to Mass, and they were speaking in Spanish. So the homily was in Spanish, and everything else was in Spanish, and we just kind of sat there. You know, we knew about the consecration and the communion, what to do, but we just felt very out of place. And we were angry. We were angry because yesterday we would have went to hell if we ate meat on Friday, and today we wouldn't. And we kept thinking, well, what else is true and isn't true about our faith? And so we were disillusioned. It was also the time when Woodstock was coming up and, you know, free love everywhere, and it was just a totally changed environment for us. I actually went with my brother and Bob and two of our friends. We were going camping for the weekend, but so they let us off, but they went on and went to Woodstock, which was, it was an amazing thing that happened because all these people were together and there was no violence. They, you know, people have tried to duplicate Woodstock, and they can't because it was just a time and space, you know, that this happened, this movement, and it can't be repeated. So anyway, we were wondering, when are we going to have children? Because, you know, we've been married for a while there, and no kids came. So we thought, well, what do people do when they want to change? Well, they buy a government surplus mail truck, get a copy of the Rand McNally camping book, and take off across country and go camping. So that's what we did. And so we had our camper, and we went across country, and we were in Oklahoma, and it was getting late, and we decided, well, we better pull off the road. And we finally found this little rest spot where there was a men's bathroom and a woman's bathroom. Outhouse, actually, with two steps, you know, going into the on each of them. So I was in the back of the mail truck, and I was getting out some food that we were going to eat that night, and I heard Bob say, "Do we have any food?" And I said, "What? What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, these two men here, they want to know if we have any food." And I'm like, "What two men? We're in the middle of nowhere. What are two men doing here, you know?" And I said, "No, just go away," I'm thinking to myself, you know. So what happened was I got out of the van, the mail truck camper, to go use the restroom. And one of the men was sitting on the steps of the men's room, and one was sitting on the steps of the women's room. And I thought, divide and conquer. This does not look good at all. So I get into the mail truck, and I said to Bob, "Put your foot on the gas and get us out of here as fast as you can, and don't ask any questions. Just do it." So he put his foot on that gas, and we flew out of there. I look in the rearview mirror, and there's those two men running after our truck, you know. If they would have just walked in and just, they could have done anything because we were innocent. You know, we were kids. I was 21 years old, and so... You know, you think you're invincible at that age. I try to tell my grandchildren that. We just one of them just turned 20. And I was like, yeah. But they don't listen because they know it, as we all did. So then we turned on the radio and we heard, "Be on the lookout for two escaped convicts that are in the area." So evidently there was a prison in the area, and the Rand McNally camping book said nothing about prisons at all. Well, we would have avoided that altogether. So then we thought, okay, where are we gonna park this truck with these people? Because then we're paranoid. We're thinking they're gonna come across that bridge, they're gonna find us, you know. And so we took off, and Bob just pulled into this one spot. We shut out the lights, and we just said, let's just go to sleep. And in the morning, as soon as day breaks, we'll get out of here. Because, you know, people asked me over the years, well, why didn't you go to the police and tell them that you saw them? And I'm saying, no, because I watched a movie called Deliverance, and there is no way I'm going to tell anybody anything. I'm getting out of here. So you know, we left. We took off. And when we woke up, we were in the United States Postal parking lot. All the other vehicles were mail trucks, just like ours, you know. But we were good, you know. We thought, we were honest. People would come running up to us, you know, and they'd say, oh, take my mail. And, you know, and I'd say, no, we're a camper. We are not a mail truck. We're a camper. So, you know. So we never took any mail that didn't belong to us. You know, but that night, for the first time in a while, I prayed. And I thanked God for saving us because, you know, it was such a moment in time that's kind of burned into your brain. We probably all have those moments, you know, something, could we have done anything different? No. No. So we continued with our trip, and we hiked to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and back up, and we saw awesome beauty. You know, sky sunsets that, you know, you could sit in front of them for 100 years and be so happy. And beauty everywhere that God had created just for us, just for me. Did I say, thank you, God? No. I just said, oh, how beautiful, you know. Because God was getting further and further away from me. So while we were coming back through the South and we went through Louisiana and we saw all these houses on stilts, and Bob said, I know a place in New York that has, they have houses on stilts. So when we got back, we checked out this island in right in Jamaica Bay between Rockaway and Queens. If any of you know anything about New York, you know, there was a little island called Broad Channel. So we bought a handyman special and moved to Broad Channel, and still no children came. You know, and we were kind of upset about that. Had all kinds of testing done, and they had said, because I had a lot of symptoms of endometriosis, but they kept telling me no. Three times I had an exploratory done, and every time they said, no, there's nothing wrong with you, you don't have it. And I think it was at the beginning of doctors finding out, knowing a little bit more about that. You know, I had one doctor that put me on 600 milligrams of Motrin for 3 years and said that people have pains, but they can't really explain. And so he gave me this Band-Aid, so to speak. And I weaned myself off of that, thank goodness. So my sisters were having babies and our friends were having babies. And the only praying I did was to say, why me, God? Why me? Why'd you choose me? What am I, a bad person? I mean, I was so furious at God. And a lot of the things I did back then were done because I was just like, get away. You know, you don't want to give me what I want. I don't care. So I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll take the back way, the sneaky way, you know, and I'll ask the Blessed Mother of God to intercede for me because, you know, the wedding feast of Cana, they told Mary that they had run out of wine. And what did she do? She went to Jesus and she told him they're out of wine. And he said, woman, my time has not come. What is it to me? And then he went and he turned the water into wine. And I wanted that power to work for me. I wanted the Blessed Mother to work for me. So I prayed this way for a couple of years and nothing happened and no children came. And one day in prayer, which, like I said, it wasn't really prayer. It was more or less, give me what I want. And I said, fine. You don't want to give me what I want? You're dead to me. I said, you're dead to me, to the Blessed Mother of God, the Queen of the Universe. Talk about, you know, burning your bridges. So we decided, well, we'll get a dog. So we got a dog. And then she had puppies. And we had two dogs. And we got two cats and two goats, and we should have built an ark. We were living on the water, you know, but we didn't. And we got 100 chickens, white leghorn chickens. And Bob built a chicken coop on stilts. And so we had our chickens and our goats, and we were all on stilts, you know, meaning the pilings that they put underneath the houses. That it was dry. We were the last house on the island, and it was dry during low tide. But high tide, you had water underneath. So we thought, well, you know, our hearts were still empty. And we thought, maybe we should try adoption. So we did. We went to an adoption agency, and a Catholic adoption agency, of course, because we were good Catholics. We really thought we were good Catholics. I mean, that's what Catholics do. Yeah, I'm Catholic. You know, I haven't been to the church since my first communion, but I'm Catholic. And that was our attitude. And anyway, they said it would be a 6-year wait, and we would have, because they didn't have any babies, and there was, they said you would have to take however old the child was up to 17 when the 6 years were over. So we said, no, well, we want a baby. Well, you know, sorry about your luck. So we just thought, well, I was like, I don't know what to do now. Well, there was a Catholic church on the island, and one Sunday I just decided I'm going to go to church, and I just went. And it was Palm Sunday. And I didn't even know it was Palm Sunday. And I used to make fun of the people that came to church on Palm Sunday. Oh, look at, they're looking for something. You know, same with Ash Wednesday. They want that black on their forehead. That's the only reason they come. Who was I? Nobody to talk like that. Because God was happy that they were there. I wasn't happy, but they were happy. And here I was, one of them. And the priest, unfortunately, he kept going like this every 5 minutes through the entire mass. And I thought, I can't be fed here. I just can't be fed here. So all the way home, I kept saying, I feel so lost, God. Where are you in my life? Where are you? I want you. I want the relationship I had with you when I was a child. You know, and just help me, Lord. I am so lost. Help me. And like the shepherd, you know, when God has shepherds that aren't taking care of their sheep, what does he do? He says, I myself will lead them. I will lead the sheep if the shepherd isn't doing his job. And so I didn't know that it said that in the Bible, because when I was a kid growing up, we weren't allowed to read the Bible. Only a priest could read the Bible. That's what the priest said. That's what the nun said. That's what our parents said. Only the priest can read the Bible, because if you interpret it wrongly, it's worse than not reading it at all. So I had never read a Bible, but I was very curious about Bibles. One time when I was younger, my family members were, my mother and father and a bunch of relatives were all looking at this big Bible. And they closed the book, and I'm kind of standing in the wings, I remember. And I went over when nobody was looking, and I picked up this Bible, and I opened it. And, you know, that was mortal sin written all over my face. And my mother swooped it out of my hands. I don't even think I got the word "the" in, because she just took that Bible, and I never saw it again. I don't know who has it, how, where it wound up, and I never had it. So anyway, about 2 weeks after the episode with going back to Mass, these two women came to my house and knocked on the door, and they said, do you know God? And they said it loud, and they weren't ashamed to say God's name loud. And that surprised me, because, you know, we had neighbors back then. Where I live now, there's nobody. So we live on an 80-acre farm. But at any rate, I was very curious about this. So I asked them to come in and have a cup of tea. So they did. And they had a Bible with them. And they started talking about the Jehovah's Witnesses. So I invited them back the following week. And they kept coming. And they gave me my very first Bible. And I read that Bible every day. I couldn't get enough of it. But still in the back of my mind, I'm thinking I'm doing something wrong, you know, because my parents had said, don't read it. You know, don't try to interpret it. But I did anyway. And, you know, I kept thinking, Jeremiah 29, my favorite scripture, when you seek me with all your heart, you will find me with you. And I thought, well, I never would have guessed it was the Jehovah's Witnesses. You know, this is bizarre. God would, you know, answer my prayers by doing this. So anyway, I was studying with them for a little bit, and I thought, you know, I better call Mom, because if she gets wind of this, it's not going to be good. You know, not at all. And so I called my mother, and I told her, and there was this dead, deafening silence on the phone. My poor mother. But anyway, when she finally said something, she said, well, I would rather you be a Jehovah's Witness than a half-baked Catholic. And I thought, ooh, you know, a slap in the face. But I deserved it, you know, and she kind of woke me up, and, you know, at that point. But anyhow, they had invited me, the Jehovah's Witnesses, to go to a Kingdom Hall, which is their place of worship. And Bob did not want me to go. He was just, I do not want you to go there, you know. And I said, look, I am going to start comparing the Catholic Church to the Jehovah's Witnesses, and I'm going to start doing some research. And I can't not go because I have to know what I'm comparing. Well, okay, I guess that made sense. But so I went. And they have what they call like a sharing time. And during the sharing time, every person that got up, and it was over 10 people, if I remember correctly, and every one of them said something bad about a nun or a priest or a Catholic. And there was the one girl, I remember her saying they had seen a priest and he had a can of beer in his hand, you know, so he was going to hell. And then there was a nun that they saw her in a doorway smoking a cigarette, so she was going to hell. And I kept hearing this, you know, keep your mouth shut, don't get up, say something. Keep your mouth shut, don't get up, say something. And finally, so I stood up, and I defended my mother, who I felt they were insulting. And then I defended my faith that I thought I had lost. And that was the end of my journey with the Jehovah's Witnesses. But I actually still am grateful to them for giving me the first Bible that I ever had. So Bob and I decided, you know, maybe it's time to go move. We should move out of where we are. And Bob put some resumes out there, and he took a job at West Virginia University. And I thought, you know, the one place I told him I would never move was West Virginia. And I apologize if I have West Virginians here, because I'm a West Virginian too now. You know, so anyway, we rented a little farm in Pennsylvania, and he worked over the Mason-Dixon line in West Virginia, so I kind of made a compromise there. And we were there for about 4 years, but before that, before we moved, we thought, maybe we should try for adoption here. Maybe it's different here than what it was in New York. So we went to the adoption agency, the Department of Health and Human Resources, and we said, you know, we want to adopt a baby. And they said, a baby girl or a baby boy? And we looked at each other like, we don't care, whatever you have. So I thought we were going to go in and, you know, there's going to be a whole room full of babies, and you just, you know, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, and you get whatever one you want. So I told that to the woman, and she's like, I didn't quite put it that way, but anyway, she said, oh, no, it'll be a 3-year wait. So I thought, well, New York was a 6-year wait, so the 3 years, all right, so it's a 3 years wait, but they're saying we're going to get a baby. So about 7 months went by, and I'll never forget it. I was making homemade ravioli. I was in the kitchen making homemade ravioli. The phone rang, Department of Health and Human Services. So I thought it was just a checkup. You know, do you still want a baby? Well, yes, you know, because we thought we had another 2.5 years or something, 2 years anyway, before they were going to give us a baby. And she said, well, do you want a baby? And I said, well, yes. And she said, okay, how does the middle of the week sound? So I said, this week? So she said, yeah, this week. Wednesday? She said, yes, Wednesday. Oh, my God, I'm going to be a mother. I'm screaming, oh, my God. I'm screaming, and I'm crying, and I'm laughing. And finally I go, I'm really not like this. I'm a very calm person, and I don't really, you know, I am very calm. And she started laughing, and she said, if you didn't have that reaction, I would have thought twice of giving you a baby. So I had two days to figure out what babies needed. And because my sisters were in New York, I really didn't know anybody there. And so she said, well, you know, it shouldn't be too hard. Don't forget you have to have a name. And I was like, okay, what are we going to name them? So there was, I don't know if it was an actor or something, but I heard the name Jason. And I'm saying, you know, that's a nice name. I never heard that name. So evidently, when he went to kindergarten, there was a lot of other people that never heard that name before, too. He was one of five Jasons in his kindergarten class. But at any rate, so we went and we got Jason, and we were just on top of the world. So happy to have that baby. And just, I didn't want to do anything else but play house. I mean, I just wanted that baby every second. And we were, you know, at the time, we rented a little farm, and we were milking goats. And we had a huge garden and horses. And, you know, horses with people from the city, I don't know what it is with us. You know, if you come from the city and you move to the country, you have to have a horse. It's like a rite of passage. You have to have a pony or a horse. And so that's the first thing I said to my husband. We're living in the country. I have to have a horse. So we ended up getting one, but at any rate, so in 1978, we bought this 80-acre farm in West Virginia, and we decided to apply for adoption again because Jason was four and he needed a little brother or sister. And so we called the Children's Home Society and the Department of Health and Human Resources because you can call and get registered with as many adoption agencies as you want to. But when one of them calls you, you have to call all the other people and say, they're going to have a baby for me. And you get taken off all the other lists because they're not going to give you 10 babies from different, you know. But so anyhow, Children's Home Society called and said that we were next on the list. We had waited 3 years, and they were going to have a baby in about 6 months for us. So we were all excited, and we called. We had only gone to two agencies, Department of Health and Human Resources. So I called them, and I said, well, we just got a notice from the Children's Home Society that they're going to have a baby for us in 6 months. And she said, well, I was just getting ready to call you. We're going to have a baby for you in 3 months. So, you know, 6 months, 3 months. So we said, okay, we'll take your baby. And we called the other people back. And we told them what happened, you know, that they're going to have a baby for us in 3 months. So she said, okay, we'll take your name off the list, and no problem. So 2 weeks go by, and I get a letter from the Department of Human Services. And it says, we regret to inform you that we are no longer placing healthy infants, only special needs children. So I called them right away, and I said, there's got to be a mistake. You said we were going to have a baby in 3 months, and now you're telling me, special needs children? What's going on? So she said, well, I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. So I said, all right, call back, you know, the other people. Can we get back on the list? Another 3 years. She said, no, because at the end of 3 years, Bob will have passed the criteria that we have for age requirements for our families. And so I said, well, you know, we'll just have to be happy with Jason. We didn't want to do foster care, because we were afraid, you know, we'd get arrested for kidnapping when they told us to bring the baby back. You know, it would just be too painful. So we thought, well, we'll just, what are we going to do? So they had sent us with this letter, another letter that had all the different children that we could choose from. You know, sibling groups, which we thought that was pretty safe, you know, two or three maybe. And we finally looked at the list, and it took us about a month, and we decided, okay, we would accept a sibling group or any kind of physical handicap. We didn't want any children that had been abused or anything like that, because we didn't really know too much about it, and we were afraid we wouldn't be able to handle it correctly. So anyway, that was what we decided to do. So we thought, while we're waiting, maybe we'll try foster care. And, you know, that little sneaky way that I have about going around the block to maybe they'll let us adopt. You know, that's what everybody thinks, that they're going to be able to adopt. And a lot of people do have the fortune, they're fortunate enough that that does happen. But with us, it didn't. So we took in these two boys, Robbie and Artie, and they were ages 5 and 2. And Artie had his third birthday party while we had them. He had never been to a birthday party, neither had the older brother. And I called my pediatrician the next day and said, you have to see these boys. Because the older boy, he was wearing these plastic cowboy boots, and they had no liners in them. And his feet were just really a mess. And they were so filthy. They'd been living in a car with their mother. And so, because her boyfriend had beat her up. And the older boy, the stepfather, had put his head into a fireplace and singed off all his eyebrows and eyelashes because he didn't do something he was supposed to do or whatever. And in my opinion, he should be in jail. But no, he was still out there somewhere. So we got the kids all, you know, got the little one toilet trained, and the older one finally would go in the bathtub, which he would scream if you try to put him in a bathtub, because evidently he'd been scalded too by this wonderful father, stepfather of his. So everybody was happy, everything was working out well, and we got a call from the Department of Human Services. The boyfriend's not beating her up anymore, and they want the kids back. So reluctantly, I said, when? And she said, tomorrow. So we had to bring the kids back. And, well, they came and they got the kids. So we said, we're not taking our name off the list. We're never doing this again. We just can't do it. So 3 months later, they called, Department of Human Services called me and said, do you know the two boys that you had, they're crying for their other mommy and daddy. And the mother said, would you please take them, because she may even let you adopt them. Adopt? You know, we'll take them. So they came back, and the little one had on a pamper, and the older one had on a pair of shorts we had bought for the little one. No shoes, no socks, no shirts, nothing. This is how we got them back. And, you know, when we let them go the first time, I had this big garbage bag full of clothes that my son Jason was only a year older than Robbie, so he could wear. And don't ever put nylon socks on him. And, you know, I actually thought she was going to read it. And she didn't, and nothing came back. They probably sold the clothes, which a lot of people in that predicament do. At any rate, you know, and Robbie's teeth were all rotted out. So I took him to our dentist, and he knew the situation, so he was very kind. We were able to get all his teeth fixed. Anyway, they called again and said, she wants the kids back. He stopped hitting her again, and they have a little trailer, and they want the kids back. So I said, when? And she said, tomorrow. I said, you know what? You come and get them today. Today. I was just beyond furious. The 5-year-old, he got in the car with the social worker, no problem. With the little one, he would not let go of me. And he was screaming, mommy, and I had to turn away from him and go back to the house. So we said, there's no way that we're going to do this again. So anyway, after Robbie and Artie left, we decided that we were going to go back to Mass on a permanent type thing and actually register with the Catholic Church and go to Mass every Sunday. But we had to find the right priest. And we decided to start with this little church, St. Ursula's, which is a tiny little church. And that Bob would pass it every day on his way to work. And he said, you know, there's something about that little church. I keep getting these strange feelings every time I pass that church, like God was drawing him in, you know. So we go to St. Ursula's, the Mass, this Sunday. And we're sitting there, and this priest comes in, and he's all happy. And he's shaking hands with everybody, and he's laughing. And I said to Bob, I'm looking around, and I said to Bob, doesn't anybody else realize this guy's drunk? So Bob goes, I don't think he's drunk. I said, well, he's too happy. Priests aren't supposed to be happy. Every priest I'd ever met up to then was very serious, very, very serious. So it was Father Jude Milley, if any of you know Father Jude. And and so he got up there and I don't remember the homily at all, but he said, you know, he would say these little jokes and things to get people listening and awake. And he would say, I was at a party the other night. He was from Boston, had a very thick Boston accent. I was at a party the other night. That's P-A-R-T-Y, potty. So, and I'm looking at Bob, this can't be Catholic. He's like, no, I think it's Catholic. But then as the Mass progressed and I saw how joyful he was, I thought, that's what's been missing, that joy. And here it is. He's got that joy. So Father Jude he would switch places with Father Goshorn. And every other Sunday he came to St. Ursula's. So he would say, you have to come to the Light of Life prayer meeting at the Good Counsel Friary, 7 o'clock every Tuesday night. So I said, you know, this is the same one that didn't think he was, you know, couldn't be a Catholic priest. And I said to Bob, I'm really curious about this. I want to go. Let's go to this prayer meeting thing. Because I'd never heard charismatic. I didn't even have any idea what it was. I'd never heard of it before in my life. And Bob's like, I'm going to Mass every Sunday. I'm not going to a prayer meeting. So I thought, I know what I'll do. So I called a friend of mine, Dee, who's Pentecostal. And I said, Dee, you have to come with me to this place. And I told her about it. And I said, this way, if there's any snakes or anything weird, you'll know what to do because you're Pentecostal. So she laughed and she said, all right, I'll go. So, and it was nothing like that. It was beautiful and it was spiritual and it was full of Bibles. So I went every week for a long time. But I got a call from the Department of Human Services shortly after that. So they had a child for us to adopt. He was 5 years old and his name was David. And we had Jason and David were our two choices for a boy. And of course, Jason was first, and then his name was already David. And so I called Bob and told him, and he said, David's his name. I said, yeah, he's ours. Let's go. Let's get him. So we got him. So my prayer life was starting to really pick up. And I was reading scripture every morning. I was praying. And during my prayer time, I would always say, you know, Lord, if you really, if you don't mind, you notice my whole demeanor is different, then why aren't you giving me a kid? You know, now I'm saying, you know, I'm treading on thin ice. And I said, you know, it would be nice to have a little girl, and maybe two. But then I promise I will stop bugging you. I will not beg for them anymore. And, you know, whatever. I said, but, you know, I'm not getting any younger here. And, I don't know, maybe in a year I'll be too old to take them or something like that, you know. So the phone rings. And I'm laughing at myself. I'm saying, no, God doesn't work this way. Guess what? It was the Department of Human Services. And she said, do you still want a little girl? And I was like, oh, my gosh. And she said, are you sitting down? And I said, no, because we had those phones, you know, you hooked on the wall. And so I was sitting on the floor under the phone by the time she got finished with me. And she said, well, we have Anna, she's 8. And then there's Michael, he's 7. And then there is Charlena, she's 6. And then there is Nellie, she's 4. And then there's Rebecca, she's 2. 5. And she said, do you want them? They're a sibling group. So I just got the goosebumps just now because just thinking about it. And I said, well, I'll have to run this by Bob. before I called Tim, I'm holding the phone. I'm still holding the phone, walking around my house, you know, however far it would reach. And I'm saying, oh, you're funny, right, Lord? This is a joke, right? You're so funny. I'm really thinking it. I'm thinking you're really funny right now. And, of course, there was nothing about it. It was true. So anyway, we decided, after meeting with the kids, we decided we were going to take them. So we brought five more into the house. And so now we had seven children. So it was like, be careful what you pray for. Because God's going to give you what you pray for and much more. So this time the kids were, you know, David, he was such a sweet kid. I mean, just, he's always been a joy. He's really, really good boy. Anyway, we bring the other kids in, and if I had chandeliers, they would have been hanging from them because they were just, I mean, it took me 2 years to get everything settled. They had all been, it was five kids, they were in four different foster homes in four different counties, in West Virginia. So they all got back together. Well, we didn't think too much of it when we saw the little boy holding the little girl's hand, you know, oh, how cute is that? And then the older girl would say, no, you don't want them holding hands. And I was like, what is she talking about, you know? Anyway, one of our daughters, she used to wake up screaming every night. And she would say something about a man with a red beard. And I said, there's nobody like that. You're just having a nightmare. Just go back to bed. So she'd go back to bed. Well, this one night she said, I have to use the bathroom. Can you come with me? Because the bathroom was downstairs and her bedroom was upstairs. So I said, all right. So I went with her to the bathroom and I'm waiting for her to get through. And all of a sudden she starts telling me these stories and my hair is standing straight on edge. I mean, I couldn't believe my ears. You know, and sometimes the social workers will say things like, well, did you lead the child in this conversation? Or... And I said, what are you kidding me? I never even heard of half of the stuff she's talking about. But it was bad. It was very bad. We're talking abuse, sexual abuse, from the time they got out of the hospital as infants. And they always got away from human services. People would turn them in for having, you know, because of neighbors and things would turn them in, and they would go to Texas. They had family down in Texas they would stay with. In fact, our youngest daughter was born in Texas. And then, you know, they'd come back when the coast was clear. Well, they finally caught up with them, and they took the kids away. And in West Virginia, it's practically impossible to get the kids, the biological kids, away from the mother. They'll do anything they can to prevent that from happening. So, at any rate, I'm walking around in a daze, and I'm the next day, and I'm saying, oh, my God, you know, the one thing, Lord, I asked you, please, not that. I didn't know what to do. One of our daughters, the same daughter that had told us all this stuff, she's looking out her bedroom window and she's crying. I said, what's the matter? And she said, do we have to leave? I said, what do you mean? She said, well, every time I ever told anybody what I told you last night, we have to leave. So then I'm thinking, well, is she tired of this place? Does she want to go somewhere else? Did she make this stuff up? Thinking, well, this is the ticket out of here. And, I just said to her, you know what? I'm your mom, and you're my daughter, and I'm not going anywhere, and neither are you. And she just turned around and hugged me and said, I love you, Mom. And she's a good kid. But these kids had never been mothered, and they'd never been fathered. They'd never been read to. They didn't know what a playground was because they'd never seen one. Or been in one. So we read to them every night and started trying to get them, you know, back on track. And we called a psychologist that we knew who was a Christian psychologist and told her what was going on. And she took the kids and we started getting them counseling right away. And they made out really well. The one boy that was involved in the sibling group of five, he didn't make out too well. You know, God didn't promise us that it would be successful in every case, but he didn't make out well at all. And he was in in Abraxas. We had gotten him into Abraxas. We wanted to get him in there. We had put him in a religious place where he would get counseling 7 days a week, because one day a week wasn't doing it. And he kept running away from the place that we sent him initially. So Abraxas was a little bit more confined, where he couldn't run away. And they had a really good reputation, but you had to be adjudicated to get in there. Now, that means you have to have done some kind of crime, especially any kind of government crime. And he hadn't committed any crime in that way. So what happened was we went to court, and he still wouldn't have been able to, the judge wouldn't have been able to send him there, except that he had taken some drugs and was so furious that he, with the place where he was, he took a couch and carried it like 2 miles by himself and threw it into this ravine. And then he made the mistake of pulling up a mailbox, and that's a federal offense. And so we were able to get him into Abraxas, and they did a really, really good job with him. And then they closed their doors and put him into private living at the age of 17, and he immediately found some girl and ran away. You know, he didn't want to work or do anything. And the last we heard from him, he was in Texas, and he had changed his last name officially, and he was married, I think, for the third or fourth time. So just pray for him, because he needs a lot of prayer. Before he went to down, that we knew about the Texas deal, he was on his second wife, and he took her truck, and he kidnapped three people. And, so he was very bad. And, I couldn't believe that when he did go away at the age of 14, that our whole house was normal. And I never realized how not normal it was until he went away. And that one kid, everybody else took a sigh of relief. You know, he would, my daughter, my oldest daughter, woke up one night, and he was standing next to her bed, and she just let out a scream. And by the time we got there, he'd already raced down the stairs, you know. And I think what did it was my son David, I went in there. He would like to read at night, and he wore glasses. So I would go in, take the glasses off, because he'd fall asleep, you know, reading, put the covers up, you know, like any mother would do. And he jumped up with a baseball bat in his hand, and I fell backwards onto the floor, and he was just, "Mom," I said, "what are you doing?" He said, "I thought you might be Michael." So I was like, "Oh, my God." You know, I hadn't realized it, because nobody told us. The kids weren't saying anything. You know, so like I said, just pray for him, because he was diagnosed early on as having and a pure example of a criminal mind. And we just thought, well, that's just a title, you know. Well, evidently it wasn't just a title. So anyhow, but the kids, they grew into beautiful children. We had my daughter Anna. She was a character. Let me tell you this first, and then I'll tell you about Anna. But one day I picked the kids up from school, and I was coming home, and they were just being so bad. Had to pull the car over three different times to settle them down. And it wasn't anything bad. It was like, well, she spit on me, he breathed on me, tell her to put her shoes back on, her feet stink, you know, all that kind of thing. Just little things. And it was just, so I get home, and I said, just go to your rooms, and don't come out till your father comes home. And I very rarely used that card, seriously. But I started crying. I went into the kitchen. I'm crying. I'm saying, you know, you told us you were going to help us, God. Where are you? You're not helping me. I can't take this anymore. And I was going on rambling, more in a holy boldness than the yelling that I did earlier in my life. But and then I said, you know, I've been duped. You don't even exist. I mean, I was just, I didn't know what to think. I was so upset. So I go into the food pantry to start getting something out for dinner. And all at once, I was frozen in time. I couldn't move. And this veil came over me. So the only way I can know to explain it is some kind of veil. And it was only for like seconds. And then the veil lifted like a curtain in a theater. And I was filled with such love that I can't even explain it to you. Unconditional love, beautiful love, all-encompassing love. And it was, I knew it was God, and I heard in my heart, not out loud, I'm right here. I'm right here. And that's the question I said, where are you? And I've got all this love going on, and I thought, oh my goodness, I went running up the stairs and I'm hugging the kids and I'm squeezing them, I'm kissing them, I love you, I love you. And they're looking at each other like 2 minutes ago, we would have had to face the wrath of Dad, and now she loves us, you know. So Bob came home and I told him what happened and I said, I've got to go to the Friary. It was a Tuesday night and that's how I remember that. And I said, I've got to tell Father Chief. And Bob's like, yeah, go. I don't care. Yeah. So I went and it was great. And during the sharing time at the Friary, I got up and I told everybody what had happened. And Father Jude laughed and he said, I was wondering, you were singing awfully loud. And I'm like, oh, I was, you know. But anyhow, that was amazing. And I'll never forget that as long as I live. And Anna's story, when my oldest daughter was 16, she's married now, by the way, and has 6 children. And she swore she would never have any children, you know. And she was the oldest girl. She's like, I don't want any kids. So, and her kids are all type A personalities like her. And she and her husband both are the same way. And if I was a kid again and had to pick where I wanted to live, it'd be her house, hands down. Every kid in the neighborhood, she invites them all over so she knows what her kids are doing. But they're all straight A students, and they're into all kinds of sports, and so I'm really grateful for Anna. But when she was a teenager, like most teenagers, they're going to do something they're not supposed to do. But Anna got her own car. From the church was selling a car, and they let her make payments on it. She got a part-time job after school, and she bought this car. Well, the only stipulation was that she could not have any kids in that car, any classmates, any friends. Thank God they didn't have cell phones back then. But that was the only stipulation. Okay, so I'm in the supermarket one day and I meet Sister Patricia, the principal of the grade school. And she says, oh, Mrs. Garubia, I have to tell you, I saw Anna and Aaron. I said, you did? And she said, yeah. They came to the school and they visited with us. And but don't worry, I walked out with them. I saw the car. They both had their seatbelts on. I said, oh, both of them? And she said, yeah. I said, oh, well, thank you, you know. So I couldn't wait for her to get home that night. And she got home and I said, guess who I met today? And she was always so bubbly. Oh, who'd you meet? You know. So I said, Sister Patricia. And she goes, she looks down, you know. And she puts her hand in her pocket, and she pulls out her keys, and she hands them to me. And she said, I won't drive for a month. And I thought, I was going to say 2 weeks, you know. And I think that's the way we are a lot of times. You know, we're harder on ourselves, you know, when it comes to forgiveness. We think God's not going to forgive us. You know, we're harder on ourselves than God would be on us for whatever it is that we've done, you know. But so I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. We had a few things happen in our family. Gary, our son-in-law, married to the second daughter, Charlene. They have 2 children. At the time, Gary passed away suddenly. He was 42. They had a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old at home. And he was weed-eating for an elderly couple. And he just died. His heart, I don't know what happened, but they said it was the widowmaker. They could not revive him. And the ambulance was there within 10 minutes. They never could revive him. And that was on, this happened on a Thursday. The following Saturday, our daughter Nellie was supposed to be getting married. And so all the people that came for the wedding ended up going to a funeral. And of course, we called them and told them what happened, and they all said they wanted to come anyway. And they did. It was a very sad time. And Bob's cousin, Paul, after the funeral, we went back to the community center. They had food for us back there. And they had no idea. None of us had any idea how many people were coming back or what was going to happen. And over 200 people came back to this little community center, and they never ran out of food. In fact, they had so much food, that they had to give food away to people to bring home with them afterwards. And Bob's cousin, who was a retired police detective in New York, and he started crying. I mean, sobbing. And we went, "What's wrong, Paul?" And he said, "I have never witnessed this kind of love in my life." He said, "If people had treated each other this way and loved each other this way, the way Christians are supposed to, we wouldn't have any crime." And he couldn't get over that. He kept saying, "We wouldn't have any crime." You know, because love drives out evil. Amen. So we were able to get through that, and I think perseverance, you know, we look back on our lives and we see all the things that happened that we said, "Why did God let this happen? Why did God let that happen?" And sometimes those kind of things give you perseverance, you know, to last, because you know, God wants nothing but the best for us. You know, it gives you the ability to let go and let God handle things. You know, trusting in him and his plan for you. Well, a couple of years later, after this whole thing happened, my mother-in-law, who lived down the road from us, she had been, you know, getting on in age. She was 90 when she moved in. And she had been kind of going downhill from the time she was 86 on. And I would go down there and, I would go down there and, you know, cook for her and clean for her and come back to my house and have to do the same. And finally, we were able to talk her into living with us. 2 weeks later, she broke her arm. She fell. And they didn't want to put a cast or anything like that. It was broken right up on the top here. And it was broken like this, you know, and it wasn't even an angle where you could fit it together. And anyway, every week, I think, or 2 weeks, I can't remember now, I had to take her to the doctors. We had to take her. And they would x-ray it to see if it was getting any closer. She had this big Velcro thing around her waist, and they had a strap here, and you had to strap it here. And anyway, so we went on almost a month, and this was the final exam. Now, before this exam, I had a lot of people praying for my mother-in-law. And, of course, you know, our family was praying for her. Well, Father Fred Byrne, he's up at La Trobe. He's a Benedictine monk. He was our pastor back then. And we said, "Father Fred, why don't you come over and pray over Evelyn?" And he said, "Sure." So he came over, and he prayed over her arm. And that following week is when she had the last exam, where they were going to say they were going to put a plate in or whatever they were going to do. And so I take my mother-in-law, and the doctor comes out, and he said, "Well, good news." So I said, "Oh, good. What are we doing?" And he said, "Well, she doesn't need the cast anymore, the Velcro thing. Just take it off and throw it away." Okay. So I said, the bone is back to, you know, coming back. And he said, "Not only is it coming back, it's completely back, and there's no sign that she ever broke her arm." Amen. Hallelujah. So anyhow, you know, so we have to be grateful for different things that we do. And when she passed away the day after Easter a few years ago, and for Easter, all of the kids were at our house. And so they all got a chance to go in and visit with her for a little bit by themselves, each one of them. And so she wanted to be cremated. And they were able to talk to her and see her the day before she passed away. And she had a very peaceful passing. And I have to wind this up real quick. I'm going to get the cane any minute. So just a few things that I'm doing now. I did a prison ministry, but only for the Life and the Spirit seminar for the prisoners at Hazleton Maximum Security Women's Prison in West Virginia. And that was no joke. You had people there that were human traffickers, murderers, you name it, mules. And, you know, when I prayed to them, I was doing the talk on God's love, and you know, and it's like looking out here, you know, but for the grace of God, go me. And she looked they looked like anybody else that I would pass on the street every day, only they got caught, you know. And when I told them that there was no sin so great that God couldn't forgive it, they started crying. They were on the floor begging God's forgiveness. It was just, it was so gut-wrenching. And, of course, we prayed with them, and many of them rested in the Spirit, if you know what that is. I'm assuming most of the people in this room know what that is. It's when you're prayed over and you kind of fall asleep for a little bit. It's the only way I can explain it, really. But anyway, it was really rewarding. But once the life of the Spirit was over, I just didn't want to do it anymore. It just wasn't my cup of tea. But, you know, the corporal works of mercy on my list have now been completed because I can check off prison ministry or visited the imprisoned. we still have the Light of Life prayer meetings. When Father Jude contacted Parkinson, and he was in pretty bad shape, and Bob was with him for the last couple of months of his life, and he asked Bob to take over Light of Life community for him because he didn't want it to die when he died. And so shortly after that, we started Catholic Radio on LOL. So we have three radio stations now, and we've helped several different stations get up and running. And many people have joined RCIA because of that station. Praise God. Right now we're doing a Life of the Spirit seminar in Wheeling for St. Vincent's de Paul's Church. And one little thing about Anna. I had asked her right before she got married, I said, you know, what's one thing that you can say that you felt or that we did right in all these years, you know? What's something that you have come away with from living with us and loving with us? And she said, that's a no-brainer, Mom. I felt safe for the first time in my life, and I wasn't afraid. When we came to stay with you, I knew my sisters would be good. I knew they would be okay. And I knew I would be okay. And thank you for that. So I wasn't looking for a thank you. I just wanted to know. And so that was my answer. So it's been a journey of love. It's been a journey of a lot of different things. But I love God. I'm back in the church. I love my faith. I love my Jesus. I love the Holy Spirit. I love my Father God. And I love all of you. And thank you for listening to me.